is matched 1-to-1. New memberships for the coming year are matched in their entirety by the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Every time someone does that from now through December 31st, it's all matched. Now is the time to double your impact with no extra dollars coming out of your pocket, because it's the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems that will do it for you. How do you do that? How do you make that happen? You start at kboo.fm. You click where it's on the word donate that appears at the top of the homepage. For folks without a reliable internet connection, call 503-231-8032. And if the receptionist isn't able to help you with it, they can connect you to someone who will. Someone will be happy to make that happen for you. So it's just about time for Digital Divide, so why don't we just get right to it? This is KBOO Portland, your community radio.
And welcome to The Digital Divide. This is your host, Rabia Yeaman. And today we're going to be talking more about artificial intelligence, autonomous drones, killer robots, and global warming. And last month we spoke with Stuart Russell, who literally wrote the textbook on artificial intelligence, and who is loosely referenced in the film Transcendence in the beginning. We spoke about what is artificial intelligence, how it works, and what the future might look like. Today we'll hear an interview with author, seminal thinker, and social scientist Howard Bloom. We'll not only discuss how the ramifications, good and evil, of autonomous computerized robots are, but we'll also hear Howard talk about killer robots, global warming, and among other topics. This interview was recorded in May 2014 with Howard Bloom. Howard is an American author and scientific thinker. He was a rock and roll publicist in the 1970s and 80s for singers and bands, including Prince, John Mellencamp, Billy Joel, Bette Midler, Styx, and many more. He's considered to be the most successful music publicist ever. Howard is also the author of 6 books, numerous papers, and, well, we'll let Howard do his own introduction. Later in the program, we'll hear a short excerpt of an interview with Nobel Peace Prize winner and longtime peace activist Jody Williams. Jody Williams is a co-founder of Code Pink and is currently conducting a campaign to preemptively ban military and governmental use of, for lack of a better description, killer robots. Killer robots are also referred to as fully autonomous weapons, and while not fully autonomous robots, not all, are programmed to kill. Opponents of autonomous artificial intelligence include notables such as Stephen Hawking. In May, the United Nations met in Geneva, Switzerland, to discuss the legality of autonomous killer semi-autonomous machines, in this case mostly drones, which have already killed thousands of humans. And world leaders believe that lethal, fully autonomous machines could follow soon enough to make them worth discussing. Anyway, the UN general took note of killer robots in his report on the protection of civilians in armed conflict issued in November 2013, saying important questions have been raised as to the ability of humans to be able to monitor and protect international rights if these robots were put into use. We're not absolutely certain they haven't already been, but right now we're going to hear our interview with Howard Bloom, so stay tuned. I'm Rabia Yeaman for The Digital Divide, and I am joined on the phone with Howard Bloom, author of The God Problem, The Lucifer Principle, and many more. Howard lives in New York and is considered by many one of the preeminent thinkers of our day. Welcome back, Howard.
Rabia, it's a pleasure to be back.
Why don't you go ahead and just introduce yourself any way that you feel inclined to do so?
Well, I'm Howard Bloom, and I'm the author of 6 books. I'm the founder of 3 international scientific groups. The first was the Group Selection Squad in Evolutionary Biology, which validated evolutionary biology, or validated group selection as a concept in evolutionary biology, made it acceptable in the pages of Nature and Science magazine. The second was the International Paleopsychology Project. The third is the Space Development Steering Committee, a group I was sort of dragooned into founding by Buzz Aldrin, and it includes Buzz Aldrin, Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man on the moon, members from the National Science Foundation, NASA, and the National Space Society. And I try to basically be intensely involved in all of the sciences the one very limited brain can understand, gather as much historical material and material from current events as one tiny little brain can understand, and fashion all of that into perceptual lenses with which to allow you, I hope, to see everything inside of you and everything around you in a different way. And that's what I try to accomplish in my books.
Well, I think you do a fine job of that. We're talking about artificial intelligence today.
Now, given the fact that artificial intelligence first rose its head in the 1970s and is a very old concept, and for a long time looked like a concept that would not really gain a footing in the practical world, that it was wildly popular in certain intellectual circles, and yet it looked like it was going nowhere. It was not living up to its promise in the 1980s. How in the year 2014 did you become interested in covering artificial intelligence once again?
Siri.
Siri, yes. What is that movie? Her?
There's that. I think that, you know, people are talking about it, but artificial intelligence really was, I mean, weren't we first introduced to the concept in the 60s with HAL?
We were introduced to the concept with HAL. It had a tremendous impact on people like Stephen Wolfram, who grew up on that movie. Stephen Wolfram is the author of A New Kind of Science and the creator of Mathematica. We were introduced to it further with people like Marvin Minsky in the 1970s, developing crude artificial intelligences. In the 1990s, a bunch of people came to my house. They were all artificial intelligence people, and they were making a little pilgrimage over here. But it's only now that artificial intelligence is beginning, and just beginning, to live up to its promise. In August 30th of 2013, roughly, I don't know how many months ago, my arithmetic is very bad, but that was roughly 8 months ago, 9 months ago, Google introduced a new algorithm. Now, Google introduces 300 to 500 algorithms a year, but this algorithm was called Hummingbird, and it no longer did what search engines have been doing ever since the 90s when search engines first appeared. It no longer just looked for your keywords.
Right.
It was aware of context. It was aware of meaning. In fact, it was designed to capture your intention, to understand what you wanted. And that is really where artificial intelligence right now, this year, 2014, is going. And that's where it's going for a large raft of companies, because the companies that are working on artificial intelligence right now include Google in a major way, Facebook, Microsoft, IBM, Amazon, and Baidu, which is the Google of China, because Google, for all practical purposes, has been locked out of China.
So are they developing, or are they investing in all of this artificial intelligence with the intent of selling us more things? Is it to market to us? Why?
I would imagine that that's a part of it, but that's not really the major part of it. That what companies like Google have learned. Remember, when Google was founded in 1998, it had no business model whatsoever. It could not figure out how it was going to make a living, how it was going to bring in an income. And for 3 years, it went with no business model. Its intent was to do the best job for you and me of making things come true that were previously true only in our fantasies that it could. And it operated on the assumption that if it did astonishing things for us, if it brought the future to reality for us, that somehow there would be a business case for it someday. And in fact, a business case eventually arrived, and Google is one of the top companies in the world today. But Google continually proceeds in this manner, and what these companies are out to do is read what you want and need before you know you need it. And that is a magnificent goal, because all of us stumble around wishing that, you know, when we just had a friend or we just had a fight with our most intimate partner, with our only intimate partner, and we get into the car, we get onto the subway, and we're all confused, and we can't talk to our friends in business about it because it would make us look small and wouldn't, you know, reflect that kind of magnificent control of everything that we like to project to those we're doing business with, that we're working with. We can't figure out anybody to talk to about it. What we want is an iPad or a cell phone or a laptop or something that will be our best friend, that will talk to us the way that apparently the computer figure in Her will talk to us intelligently, sympathetically. We humans deeply need attention. We deeply need companionship. We deeply need help. We need it a lot of the time. And the ultimate is to have a genie in the bottle who's also your best friend and your psychotherapist and preferably the opposite sex. And that is a long way from being true right now.
But isn't that a dangerous... Some people are really afraid of that.
Well, Stephen Hawking.
That's right. Because
really
and Stuart Russell, you know, who talks about there being a lot of loopholes. You know, when you ask for something, you aren't able to anticipate all of the repercussions and ramifications of actually getting what you wanted.
Well, that's true. And you know that Stephen Hawking and Russell and Max Tegmark and one other author all got together, and Frank Vilcek, who is a Nobel Prize winning physicist at Harvard, They all got together and they wrote a short editorial for The Independent in London, and they warned that the achievement of artificial intelligence could be the greatest thing ever to happen in the history of the human race, and it could also be the last thing ever to happen.
That's right, because if we develop an intelligent machine that can make autonomous decisions before we've fully given, you know, just thoughtful consideration
right
to what that means, then that's definitely our folly.
Well, I don't think it's our folly. And look, I'm a person who lives with electronic prosthetics. I couldn't exist without electronic prosthetics. I have 2 8-hour recorders strapped to the right breast pocket of my shirt. I have an electronic pedometer right next to it. I've got 2 Kindles in a holster that hangs from my belt, so they go with me everywhere. And God knows what all else, and a cell phone. And I couldn't live without those things. And they pump me information. They pump me, even when I forget somebody's name, and you know that we humans all have to pretend that we remember names because we think everybody else does. But in reality, not a single one of us remembers names, and it's very embarrassing. And even when I have to find names, the computer helps me out. And all of these forms of help are terrific. And now a little bit of this attempt to understand what you really want is coming alive in Google Chrome. So you start typing in something, and Google Chrome knows your history, and Google Chrome anticipates what it thinks you want to type. And guess what? It gets it right. I mean, it gives you 15 choices.
It does. It gets it right a lot of the time.
And boy, does that help. Now, I've never been able to use Google Now because it won't run on the Android that's on my Samsung phone. But from all the reports. And Google now is helping people because it's anticipating your needs by looking at your schedule. And it's trying to remind you of things that are absolutely vital to you, and it's trying to remind you of the details, the little checklists of things that you have to do. It's trying to act as your personal assistant and your best friend. It's trying to act, in the words of one of the tech writers, it acts like Jeeves acted for Bertie Wooster. I mean, Bertie Wooster in the P.G. Wodehouse stories was a dumbbell, but he was an upper-class dumbbell, so he could afford a butler. The butler was smart, and the two of them together were an unbeatable team, mostly because of the smarts of the butler. Well, that's what this year's approach to artificial intelligence seems focused on doing. It seems focused on producing personal assistants who can extend our powers. And that's what technology's always been about, extending our powers. Is there a risk to technology? Yes. But one thing that we know from the history of protests against technology, the famous saboteurs who put their wooden shoes into the new weaving machines.
The Luddites.
The Luddites. But those weaving machines would later make people on their level of society far richer than they ever dreamed they could be. And if we start with the Luddite assumptions that everything's a risk and a danger, and we don't explore the possibilities of things, we end up crippling ourselves. The whole movement, I was in early on the movement toward assessing the morals of things in advance in science. Back in the 1990s, the editor of the leading journal in the field asked me to write for him. And I've always been apprehensive about the moralists, because the moralists can stop things from happening. And some of the things that can't happen, everything is a risk.
Well, and that's very subjective, morals and values. And that also, you know, when we're talking about artificial intelligence, and we're saying, well, we have to input data, but there's a concern that the controllers of the intelligent machines, that the machines would adopt their subjective values and morals, because those are so variable amongst people.
Well, the job of the artificial intelligences that are being developed now are to find your morals and values and help you extend them, expand them in any way that you want. Now, any machine can be used for good or evil. A hammer can be used to build a house, or a hammer can be used to kill. And if we'd sat down and ethically thought out the consequences of the hammer and realized how many people would be killed by some variation on the hammer, at the very beginning of the hammer's existence, 2.5 million years ago, when we made the first ones from stone, we would never have become humanity. Because humanity is remarkable in one respect. Every other animal that needs to eat meat, and we do need to eat meat, we get around it with vegetarianism, but we're built to eat meat. Every other animal that is built to eat meat is equipped with claws and fangs. More than that, it's equipped with a thermoregulatory system that can carry it through winter blizzards and blistering summers. It's got more than just all that fur. It's got a lot of thermoregulatory apparatus. We were born without that thermoregulatory apparatus. We were born without fangs. We were born without claws. In other words, we were born with only one hope. And that hope was to become a technological species, make our own fangs, mm-hmm. make our own claws, make our own fur coats. And that is what, over the last 2.5 million years since we invented our first stone tools, has made us human. Have all of those inventions of ours, almost all of them, involved some sort of ethical risk? Yes, they could all be used for evil, not for good.
Only that, when we read about artificial intelligence and how it's used, you know, by larger corporations and the government, you know, that people talk about it, that it's beneficial and will continue to be beneficial in helping us to form conclusions and make recommendations and solve problems. But let me ask you, Howard, if artificial intelligence forms conclusions and makes recommendations, you know, based on the most likely outcomes, then how will that affect decision-making, you know, and innovation when our progress as a civilization up till now has mostly occurred by visionaries who were seen at the time as having the least likely outcomes?
Right. Well, I think it's going to help us enormously. When Mosaic first came along, the first web browser, and then AltaVista and Excite and search engines. Up until then, my job as an author had been to go to the library or wherever I had to go to gather the most amount of data that I could to give you the best books I could possibly give you. And the amount of time that it took me to go through library books was appalling. It meant that I could give you very few of my thoughts because I had to spend so much time gathering the facts and the details to either find out for myself that those thoughts were not accurate or to sharpen the thoughts and get them across to you with the relevant information that would prove that I was saying something of value. 95% of my time was research time. 5% of my time was thinking, inventing, and being a visionary time. Today, I can do the research that sometimes took me 2 weeks in 2 hours, thanks to Google, thanks to Google Books, thanks to all the stuff that's available.
Well, it is absolutely profound. I mean, the Internet eliminated logistics.
Right. But what that meant is that I have no value in life if I'm not a visionary of some kind, because I can't play baseball, I can't play football, I can't do anything practical in life. You know, so
gosh, all that's left is visionary.
All that's left is ideas. All that's left is trying to give you ideas that will utterly change the way you see things around you, if I'm fortunate to be able to do that. And instead of dedicating only 5% of my time in working on a book to that, I can now dedicate 50% of my time to the part that really matters the most. So you would think that with the web doing all the work that I used to do, there's no need for me anymore. No, it's moved me up on the scale. It's like that famous pyramid of human needs, where you've got breathing oxygen at the bottom and drinking water above that and eating food above that, and then you get to the luxury things like love and warmth and affection and sex and thinking and ideas and dreaming. But only once you've got the bottom things in the pyramid filled can you take care of those things on top. Well, machines, whatever we want to call them, electronic gadgets, are filling in more and more of those bottom layers of the pyramid. And they're making it possible for more and more people to go to the top and do what humans are really here to do, integrate information, have great dreams, have enormous visions, have the persistence to hammer those visions home, and turn them into some sort of reality.
Let's talk a little bit about, you know, sort of the nuts and bolts without getting too techie. And I know that in artificial intelligence, they use probability computing, and Watson is kind of based on cognitive computing.
Right.
What's the difference for our listeners?
I was on a panel in San Diego. It was called Demo 2008, with Peter Norvig, who's the head of research and development for Google, with the head of research and development for Yahoo, and with a, what did they call him, some sort of a prophet from Microsoft. And from that conversation on stage in front of an audience, projecting what the future of the Internet would hold, I got my first sense of what big data was from Peter Norvig. And big data is taking the biggest pools of data you can find and then applying Bayesian algorithms and other statistical techniques to them to try to find pattern within them. And that is still the approach that's being taken by big data. And from what I can see, it's still the approach being taken by all of the major players in the artificial intelligence business, including, so far as I can tell, including Watson. And you know that right now IBM is partnering with small startup companies to get them to develop apps based on Watson's cognitive intelligence. All of these things are aiming toward cognitive intelligence.
But it's not really natural. I mean, it isn't like human intelligence. It's still programmed. It's still data in, data out.
You're right. And although it is producing some good initial results, there's something else about humans. We have vision. We have 40 visual centers in our brain, and we don't know what we're talking about when we say vision. But sometimes we have a premonition. It's a totally secular premonition of what can be.
And intuition. We have intuition.
Yeah, and we know it with absolute precision. Sometimes we absolutely know it, and when we know it with that profundity, sometimes we're willing to dedicate ourselves to it and have the persistence to make it come true. Now, computers are not yet up to that level of having overarching pattern. One of the people I met, you know, in 2010, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, through a forum based on my second book, Global Brain, The Evolution of Mass Mind from the Big Bang to the 21st Century. And they brought in people from the State Department, the Energy Department, DARPA, and they flew in people from IBM and MIT. And the person they flew in from IBM's Almaden lab in California was Dharma Mahendra. And Dharma Mahendra at that point was in the middle of something really remarkable. He had a computer called Deep Blue Genes, an IBM computer. It had roughly 157,720 microprocessors wired in parallel. Normally in your computer you have one microprocessor and everything goes in serial order through it. All the information has to line up in single file to go through your microprocessor. Well, information could line up in 157,720 files on this computer. And that's much like the brain. The brain has 100 billion neurons, and they operate in parallel. They don't pass something along first to one neuron, then to the next neuron, then to neuron number three. If they did that, we'd have no brain. And the thing that was missing, Dharma is a marvelous man, and he was funded by DARPA. His DARPA program manager was in this session, and he went on to simulate 2 seconds in the brain of a rat. Then he was able to simulate 2 seconds in the brain of a cat. And his goal was to be able to simulate a human brain so that something magical would come popping out, an emergent property, consciousness. Well, he's still a long way from that, because I saw the kinds of algorithms with which he was working, and they didn't take into account larger pattern. They didn't take into account the kind of pattern recognition that you and I call vision or insight or a wow and aha experience. But they will get there someday. And like any technology, what they produce can be used to give you powers utterly beyond your belief and make you far more human than you could have been in 2014.
Are you suggesting, Howard, that in the future that humans and machines will merge to varying degrees? And the machines will, and I'm not having any judgment about it.
Yeah.
And the machines will augment us.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That has been our nature since that first stone tool 2.5 million years ago. You know, about 800,000 years ago, we tamed an utter catastrophe and a disaster, one that was so dangerous that if we'd had ethicists around trying to feel out the negative implications of things, they would have told us, don't touch this stuff. It was called fire. And with it, we were able to do something no animal in the history of the cosmos had ever been able to do. We were able to cook our food. Now, our cousins, the gorillas, have these huge beer barrel-sized guts, and they have those guts for a reason. They don't eat cooked food. They're eating leaves, and it's very, very hard to digest leaves. So in essence, a mountain gorilla, the kind that Diane Fossey used to study in the Virunga Mountains, a mountain gorilla is this huge container, this huge fermenting vessel to digest these leaves, carried around on little legs. And a gorilla cannot get very far in its life. It can't wander the way we humans do. What allowed us humans to wander? We started to cook our food.
Fire,
and when we started to cook our food, we did externally what that huge beer barrel-sized gut does for the mountain gorilla. And when we were able to externalize that process using fire, all of a sudden we developed these tiny little tummies, and we could walk upright with grace and agility. And we could run. Humans actually can outrun most animals. Yes, a jaguar can outrun us in a short sprint, but when it comes to the long run, literally the long run, humans win. And humans got that agility by marrying themselves to a technology.
I will get other humans to win for me, Howard. That race.
Well, no, I don't want to ever kill an animal in my life.
We only run in Portland. The only reason to run is because the police are chasing you.
Oh, my. Well, what about, did I see any joggers when I was in Portland? I can't remember.
Well, I can't imagine you didn't.
No, I saw a lot of homeless people, and people kept telling me over and over again that Portland has more topless bars than any other city, I mean, per inhabitant, any other city in the world, which I found rather shocking because I went to Reed College there, and that wasn't my impression of Portland, Oregon.
PDX Pride, way to be classy, Portland.
Right. So, but I think this stuff will be wonderful for us. And every time we are shoved out of the lower layers of the pyramid, or we are allowed to leave those lower layers of the pyramid, we ascend to a new layer of the pyramid. And sometimes we create layers of the pyramid that never would have existed without that machine-human interface that's been going on since we built the first stone tool.
So,
And as for good and evil, there was a very interesting article in Technology Review about 20 years ago that said, in essence, we in the West assume that the printing press always liberates people, because that's what it did from roughly 1550, when Gutenberg invented it, up until today in Western society. But again, a hammer can be used to kill, or a hammer can be used to build a house. And in Russia, the printing press was used for exactly the opposite purpose. It was used to tyrannize people. It was used for totalitarian autocracy. And so in the days of the czars, the printing presses were imported to Russia almost as soon as they were imported to the rest of Europe from Gutenberg's Germany. But the printing presses in Russia were a monopoly. They were owned exclusively by the government, and they were used for one purpose and one purpose only, to print ukases. A ukase is a decree from the czar. And so the same instrument that was used to set people free in the West was used to homogenize people, to beat them down, to turn them into serfs and slaves.
Well, you know, it's a good comparison, but it doesn't feel the same to me, and here's why. Because it's not necessarily evil. It's not necessarily that a machine would turn to an evil Disney robot, but a robotic intelligent machine that, let's say, because I think the fear is that they would become autonomous.
Right. And in fact, that's what they're being designed for.
And they become autonomous and where that they can update, replicate, and change any system that they want with abilities far beyond human abilities, that not maliciously per se, but people are we can do some damage. A machine might decide that people are obsolete. People are actually cause more harm than good. I'm not saying they do. I'm saying a machine in the future might simply see humans as not beneficial to the overall picture.
Well, you're not alone in feeling that way. Isaac Asimov, who was one of the greatest science fiction authors and futurists of all time, felt that way in the early 1950s. And he wrote the 5 Rules of Robotics. And those 5 rules were written so that robots wouldn't kill people, robots wouldn't do people any harm, so that robots wouldn't go off the track and become evil monsters. It's very unlikely that a robot would develop the same kind of motivational machinery that humans do. Humans, unfortunately, are built with motivational machinery that justifies war. I mean, it's not our fault. It's not unique to humans. It turns out that bacteria, our oldest ancestors, our foremothers, 3.85 billion years ago, made war, and they made war with weapons of mass destruction. It turns out that even chimpanzees, Jane Goodall went and spent 20 years with the chimpanzees in Gombe, and she was blissful. Now, she had seen that chimpanzees will do horrible things to each other. They will beat each other up. They will break each other's bones. Sometimes they will rip your scrotum off. They can be quite monstrous.
It's harsh.
One-on-one, or in gang beatings. But the one thing that she found they didn't have was war. And she was exuberant. And she wrote her first book basically saying, here is a species without war. This proves that war is unique to humans and their social structures. Then she went back to Gombe, and guess what she discovered? She hadn't waited long enough. Warfare among chimpanzees is a generational kind of thing. It only happens every 20 years or so. And she saw war among the chimps. It was horrible. It was brutal. It was mean and cruel, and it made her sick. And she wrote a second book. Thank God she was in.
She had to retract what she said.
Oh, yes, she certainly did. So the motivations for war, the hierarchical motivations, the I want to be on the top of the pecking order sort of motivations that ultimately drive war. Those are built into our biology. It's very unlikely that we would build that kind of thing into a machine. Yes, we build killing into machines. We're doing it right now with drones. And we have to make sure that that killing machinery doesn't take off and kill us all. But there are people dedicated to that. You know, in my book, The Genius of the Beast, A Radical Revision of Capitalism, I tried to show that the Western system is not what we think it is. It is not just private industry, and it is not just government. It is those two things plus a third element that we never look at, the protest industry. And the protest industry has been around since 1760 to 1780 when the anti-slavery movement started. And the protest industry experienced its first great victory in 1808, not long after it had been founded, when slavery was outlawed in England. The protest industry went further when Henry David Thoreau in 1848 saw a totally unjust war taking place, the war with Mexico, and refused to pay his taxes and wrote a book about it called On Civil Disobedience, without which we wouldn't have had Gandhi and we wouldn't have had Martin Luther King.
Right.
Well, I have a friend, you know, I write all my books at a big cafe called the Tea Lounge here in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and there are some very interesting people who are also doing their work there, and one of them is one of the leading people on the robot ethics side of things. He's a top person in an organization that specializes in making sure robots do not kill. And the last time I saw him, I think it was a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, just before I went to California, he was on his way to Geneva for a major international conference on stopping robots from killing. So our society works on a balance between optimists like me and pessimists like him. And optimists like me are willing to point out all the great things, all the fantastic things. And I need them, you know, because I'm a puny little soul, and without these machines, I'm nothing.
I don't want to give mine up either. I love them.
Yeah. So, but and then I have my friend Peter, who devotes his entire life, full time, paid for by Princeton University, to make sure that these things never kill anybody. Now, someday Peter and I are going to disagree about something, but it's the balance between opposites that makes a good society work. And it's the balance between, it's the use of the hammer. It is the use of the hammer to build houses and the refusal to use a hammer to kill that makes a society rich. And our society is rich in a couple of respects that it's very important to note. In 2001, when we had 9/11, friends started trooping out to my brownstone. It was the only way to get to me. I was stuck in a bed for 15 years with an illness, so they came out to my bedroom. And they would all say the same thing. Western society is about to die, and it deserves it, because it's the worst civilization in the history of mankind. It's killed more people than any civilization in history. And it's taken me many years to do the research, but it turns out they were wrong. If you'd been born in 1850 in Western civilization, your lifespan or your life expectancy would have been 38.5 years. If you'd been born in Western culture in 2000, your life expectancy would have been more than twice as long. 78.5 years. If you had been born in, or if you had been the poorest paid worker in London in 2000, you would have earned what an entire tenement full of the poorest paid workers in London earned in 1850. And if you took an average group of kids from the street who we are told are being dumbed down by Facebook and Twitter, not to mention Tumblr, if you gave those kids a Stanford-Binet IQ test, from 1900, they would measure as marginal geniuses. They would come out with an approximate average IQ of 135. That's 35 IQ points we've added in Western civilization in 100 years. And the most important fact is the one that I first brought up in my first book, The Lucifer Principle, and then Steven Pinker turned into an entire book and a brilliant, amazing book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. The fact is that if you had been born in 1650 in Western society, your chances of dying a violent death at the hands of another human, would have been 9 times what they are today in modern Western civilization. If you had been born into an indigenous tribe, the people who live at peace and harmony with nature and at peace with each other, your odds would also have been 9 times what they are today, which means that this Western civilization that we're told is the worst in the history of mankind has actually increased the amount of peace by a factor of 9. That is astonishing.
That is a huge amount, and it's totally believable to me. That feels like hyperbole, you know, and sensationalism.
Take a look at Stephen's book, because in my book I only had a page and a half on it, but I cited a bunch of research. Steven Pinker's book is 650 pages of research on it, and it is meticulously done. Meticulously done.
Well, I'm glad that you're an optimist, Howard, and that you that you can contribute a point of view that can show us the benefits while other people try to close those loopholes.
Right. Well, we need them. We need Stephen Hawking and Max Tegmark and the group to look for the problems. We need people like my friend Peter at Princeton to look for the problems and help us prevent them. But remember, the flip side of what Stephen Hawking said in his editorial, his op-ed, was artificial intelligence could be the greatest thing that mankind has ever done.
Well, it will be, no matter what the outcomes are, it will be. It could be that next step, that next evolutionary step for humans.
And remember, it will take kids in the street, just as the smartphone, the cell phone, right now, is taking people in Nigeria and lifting them to levels they've never been on before, taking people in Africa and lifting them to levels they've never been on before. The smartphone is doing, it's allowing people to transfer payments. So people who are living in a country in order to make a living and have to send their money back to their family are no longer ripped off by sharks who charge them 20% and may never get the money back home at all.
That's right. There's an app for that.
Right. And fishermen are going out catching fish and are able to phone back to the shore and find out which town has the highest price, in other words, the greatest need, for the fish they've just caught. And fisherwomen in Nigeria are able to keep the fish in the water so that they're kept alive and fresh and take orders by phone and only kill a fish when there's a customer for the fish. I mean, it's changing the economy of Africa, and it's taking the poorest people, people who only earned $1.98 in a cash wage per year just 15 to 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and it's lifting them, and it's lifting them rapidly. So that's what we need to accentuate. That's what we need to increase, not just lifting the poor, but lifting the potential of even the poorest kids around. There was an experiment done. You know, there's this team at MIT that has been building very inexpensive computers to get to kids in the third world. And they took one of their computers, preloaded it with a whole bunch of software, left it in the middle of a village of illiterate people, and just to see what would happen. The kids got so curious about it. And by the way, there are many experiments of this sort. The kids got extremely curious about it, and within 6 months had taught themselves English, read, and the rudiments of programming. That means there are so much smarts on this planet. There are 7 billion brains just waiting to be lifted up that pyramid so they don't have to worry about the basics like water and food anymore. And so they can start using their brains, and so they can start contributing to the collective spirit of mankind.
You know, before I let you go, this doesn't have anything to do, but I have you on the phone, and, you know, that's a valuable, rare thing for me, and so I so appreciate it. I just wanted to kind of get your, brief feedback about the recent news about the Antarctic ice melting.
Well, I just gave a speech on this at the National Space Society's annual convention. By the way, what I've just come back from is the Caltech Institute of, it's called the Keck Institute of Space Studies, flew me out to California for a 5-day brainstorming session with some of the most amazing people in the creation of the machinery that goes into probes into space and in managing the probes that go into space. It's been an astonishing experience. I gave a speech out there, and what I tried to say in this speech is this is a planet of climate catastrophe. It always has been. At various times, it's been called Snowball Earth because there's been up to 6 feet of snow at the equator. At various times, there have been global warming so profound that from 145 million years ago to 90 million years ago, there were dinosaurs living in tropical paradises in Antarctica. So this has been a climate of planet of nonstop climate change. And the trick for us is we have to recognize that what we really want is climate stability. And this planet has never offered climate stability, ever. I mean, the ice ages were created or happened, and the global warmings happened long before there were human beings. So we have to recognize that all we want to achieve is anthropogenic climate stabilization. And what we are really talking about when we're talking about taking greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere is developing technologies with which to stabilize the climate so we neither have global warmings that put us all underwater or global freezes that put us all under ice, because that's a very likely possibility given the history of this particular planet. So we have to get serious about something that's not new to us. We started manipulating climate when we built the first walls and the first roofs on houses, but that's microclimate control. Now we have to go after macroclimate control, and that's really what the attempts at carbon sequestration are about. And there, I was in Japan a month ago at a conference on harvesting solar power in space and transmitting it down to Earth, the way that we transmit the satellite signals that power your dish TV or that your cell phone uses. And two of the people presenting at this conference presented on anthropogenic climate stabilization technologies. So it's the beginning of something that we have to recognize is anthropogenic, that is our decision, that we prefer to keep New York where it is,
right,
on the shore rather than underwater. That's our decision. That isn't the way nature operates.
That's right.
And having made that decision, we have to move forward into a difficult technology, and we have to take it step by step so we don't do harm, so we do more good than harm.
Do you think that artificial intelligence will help us solve that particular problem?
I would bet you that it will make the solution of that problem an awful lot easier, because it will allow us to do data searches of a kind that would normally take 6 grad students. And it would normally take 6 grad students 3 years, and we could do them in 3 months, or 3 days, or sometimes 3 hours.
Well, that certainly is, you know, profound in that way of giving us access to information or even solutions at a much more rapid pace.
But the tip of the spear will be what it's always been. It will be dedicated, intelligent, creative, imaginative, visionary human beings. The shaft of the spear is the artificial intelligence. The tip of the spear is still you and me.
Howard, I am so happy to talk to you today.
Well, I'm delighted. I was looking forward to talking to you again. It's been a long time.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks, Rabia. I will see you in June.
Bye. And that was an interview with author and scientist Howard Bloom, scientific thinker. We do want to wish Howard happy birthday once again, and I love that ending to the interview where you can hear a little bit of Brooklyn in the background with the sirens. Up next, we're going to hear a short an excerpt from an interview with Nobel Peace Prize winner and peace activist Jody Williams, a co-founder of Code Pink and currently conducting a campaign to preemptively ban military and governmental use of killer robots.
When we say killer robots, most people think of drones. But killer robots are weapons that would make drones look primitive. At least with a drone, there is a human being who looks at a computer screen, sees the target, and pushes the buttons to fire the missiles and kill. Various militaries are doing research on weapons that would have no human being involved in the targeting and killing of human beings. And we found that shocking and horrifying, that people are really thinking it is okay to give the right to target and kill human beings to machines. But there are many precursors to what we call killer robots. The U.S., for example, is testing the X-47B, which is a subsonic super drone, as it is called. The U.K. is testing the Taranis. European countries under France are testing the Neuron. China has just tested its own stealth drone. We're not quite certain about what Russia is testing, but I do know that Russia announced in 2013 that they would be opening a military robot center in 2014. And there are prototypes from the stealth drones all the way down to micro robots, which are the size of a mosquito, that could fly into a room and either do surveillance or fly into a room and, you know, inject a toxin and kill the target. Mm-hmm. And it's very frightening that people think this is okay.
But wouldn't it still take a human being to actually switch it on and direct it one way or another?
It would take the robot to be programmed, but once it was set free, it would proceed to make the targeting and kill decisions, unless our campaign to stop killer robots is able to make certain that human beings have to be involved meaningfully in the kill decision.
Just because, before we get into the whole moral side of the story, I want to know a little bit more about the technicalities. So are these things uncontrollable once they're put in action, or can you actually stop them, reverse the action, bring them back?
Mm-hmm. That we don't know yet, because as you point out, these are still in the prototype and testing phase. Robotic scientists, some of whom are part of our campaign, talk often about what would happen if a squadron, for example, of stealth killer drones were set free and they were hacked, just like computer hackers hack into, you know, computer systems. There is no saying that they couldn't hack into a killer drone squadron and set it amok. Who then is responsible for the killings by the killer robots? Mm-hmm. Is it the programmer Is it the commander somehow in charge of the squadron? Is it the person who programmed the robot? Is it the producer of the robot? In international law, mm-hmm. there has to be a direct chain of command and accountability. That is another part of this that makes it ethically unsound and morally reprehensible, quite frankly.
Now, landmines were banned after many people suffered. Will you be taken seriously, considering
true.
There have been no victims yet?
We have been taken seriously, which is one of the amazing things about this, Sophie. We only launched the campaign to stop killer robots in April of this year being 2013. And within 7 months, which is now, the international community is going to be taking up the question here in Geneva next May, I think it is, in a 4-day-long meeting on killer robots. And it will be governments of the world under the umbrella of the Convention on Conventional Weapons here in Geneva who will be addressing this issue. And we're hoping they will go further and we will continue a dialogue to lead to a new international instrument that would prohibit, mm-hmm. you know, fully autonomous killer robots. So it's not something that we're being ridiculed for anymore. Mm-hmm. Although you're correct. When we first used the term killer robots, some people said we're using scare tactics. And that's not true. We want to capture public attention, which means you use language that makes people stop and think. But immediately, military started responding to us, showing clearly that we are not making things up. This is not science fiction. And I wish it were, to be quite honest with you.
Jody, I'm just wondering, have you personally had a chance to talk to people, directly to people who are making these autonomous weapons? Do they actually consider the dangers of what they're building?
Well, I haven't spoken to them yet myself, but I intend to. They're aware. There is an increasingly robust dialogue about this, especially among lawyers, as you can imagine, on both sides of the argument. the anti-killer robot side, saying that that international law as it stands now cannot fully deal with this new technology. And others on the side that believe fully autonomous weapons are, you know, the best thing after sliced white bread, argue that they're a good thing and international law can deal with them and all we need is best practices. But when the United States, which is the only country to have done so far, produced its military directive on drone research, not drone, I'm sorry, killer robot research, they actually listed a very long series of concerns that need to be looked at in terms of killer robots. So even the U.S. military, which has long considered that killer robots are inevitable and will be part of the U.S. military force, recognizes that these are very problematic. Mm-hmm. And we intend to amplify that, if you will.
But so what do you say to those who argue that autonomous systems are in our future? It's an irreversible process. And if governments don't use them in a regulated way, they will end up being used by rebel groups and non-government actors.
No, because rebel groups and non-government actors could never produce them on their own. Unless high-tech militaries like the United States, Israel, South Korea, China, Russia, unless those militaries and the so-called defense industries produce them.
And that was a very crisp ending on a special episode of Digital Divide, featuring conversation with Howard Bloom, author of The God Problem, and a brief excerpt. Well, this is KBOO Portland. It's coming up on 11:56 a.m. Ushering in the post-meridian will be your very own, the inimitable, the one and only, and what a mensch, Don Jacobson, bringing you Moving On. But first, this.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Radical Chorus Workshop and Skillshare on December 11th at 3 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Led by Mo Baustern, founding member of the Amalgamated Everlasting Union Chorus Local 824, the Radical Chorus Workshop and Skillshare will define what a radical chorus is, discuss affinity groups, protests, and the effectiveness of fabulous outfits, and teach protest songs by Chumbawamba, The Frogs, Loretta Lynn, and more. Again, that's the Radical Chorus Workshop and Skillshare on December 11th at 3 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is gearing up to celebrate 50 years of community radio, and we need your help. Take the Big Events Survey on kboo.fm and help us decide what kind of events you would attend or help build. Go to kboo.fm and click on the survey banner to help prepare for the Kaleidoscope of KBOO, Past, Present, and Future, 50th Anniversary Celebration.
To KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge at 91.9 FM, Philomath and Corvallis at 104.3 FM, and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose, no good to nobody, no good for nothing, because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down or songs that poke fun at you on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I am out to fight those kind of songs to my very last breath of air and my last drop of blood. I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from All Classical Portland, presenting Mark O'Connor's An Appalachian Christmas, featuring the O'Connor Band and guest Nancy Ives, Wednesday, December 14th at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. An Appalachian Christmas features seasonal carols infused with bluegrass, folk, and Americana on banjos, fiddles, mandolin, and upright bass. A holiday tradition for Portlanders. Tickets at allclassical.org. Well, today is my birthday, so I am going to play a birthday set for myself, starting off with John McCutcheon from his album Water from Another Time. We're going to hear Cut the Cake.
We're gonna let second grade out early today, which made little Mikey kind of blue. You see, he just turned 7 years old that day, and he thought he'd get a party at school. He walked to his house and he's taking off his guard. There's chairs and tables all over the yard, and his friends jumped up and they hollered real hard.
Happy birthday to you. It makes me think of the good old days. Happy birthday to you. You sure grew out of your baby ways.